Why did you decide that you needed to tell your story?
You know, it seemed like for the last few years, everybody's telling stories. Books were coming out right and left. And I thought maybe I too had something to say.
You grew up on Page Street. Where was it?
Page Street was between Norris and Diamond and between 16th and 17th, my block.
It seems like your mother was devoted to you.
Oh, she was my champion. But she used to beat my butt endlessly because I was a naughty little boy in elementary school.
Were you a little scrappy, kind of?
I was in fights, you name it, disruptive. And she'd send notes home to my mother. But I got my mother's signature down. And my mother never got any of those. Until she came to school one day, parent-teacher's day. And I said, oh, my mother, she works. She can't come. And who steps through the door? My mother. And when the teacher got to me explaining, you know, oh, Mrs. Jones, your daughter is great. And Mrs. Brown, your son. Mrs. Golson, I'm sorry I had to send all those letters. My mother said, what letters? I don't have to tell you what followed when I went home.
Yeah, I bet that was not a good night.
Yeah, but she did it because she loved me. I mean, I didn't appreciate it then, but I appreciate it now.
And can you tell me the story of how she bought you your first saxophone and brought it home?
That was almost strange because I was a piano student prior to that. And when I told her I wanted to be a saxophone player, she says, oh my God, you're going to be a dope addict. Yeah, she thought that. But as it turned out, she wanted me to be happy. And I assured her that I wasn't approaching this because of dope. It was because of the music. And I thought we were on welfare then. Well, just gotten off of welfare. And I thought if I got a saxophone, it would be one from the pawn shop, one of those old silver saxophones.
Mm-hmm.
But she brought me a brand new one. I couldn't believe it. My heart almost jumped out of my body. And John Coltrane and I became good friends, and she encouraged both of us so much.
You know, it's amazing that you, the two of you, were able to become such good friends when you were little.
We were like brothers.
That's a stroke of luck.
Every day, trying to learn what this music was all about. It wasn't laborious, or if it was, we weren't aware of it. We enjoyed it. We loved it. Because we were learning something. As time went by, we learned a little more. And it was getting us to where we wanted to go, and we didn't know where we wanted to go, but we wanted to get there as soon as possible. Yeah, that's the way it was. I was 16 and he was 18 when we met.
Both teenagers.
Dumb teenagers. And we stayed friends right up until the time he died. Yeah. Broke my heart.
I see that in the beginning of the book. You talk about how when you learned that he died.
Broke my heart.
And you say that, you know, the four big events in your life, you know, when your mom bought you the sax, when you met your wife, right?
Yes.
What else?
That was my second wife.
Bobby. There are a couple other things.
That was my daughter when she was born. Brielle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's my sweetheart.
But and what is it about Steven Spielberg? That was the fourth thing.
Steven Spielberg, he thought, this sounds a little strange, he thought like I did. That is, he was never satisfied with things being this way or that way. There were other possibilities. And I thought that way about my music. I was always searching. And I never wanted to be satisfied. Creativity is not about being permanently satisfied. No, if you're young enough, there are other things that you can pursue. What is this over there? What is behind that door as you walk down the corridor of life? What happens behind that door? And sometimes you get delightful surprises, and sometimes they're not so good. Oh, yeah, because those are the bad experiences, racism and things like that early in my life. Yeah. I didn't understand that until later. I didn't know what it was at first.
Are there any of those experiences that you want to talk about?
Yeah, when we went south and my uncle went with us, Uncle Robert, and I guess I was about 5 years old. Yeah, I think I was just about 5 years old. And I'd always known him as a formidable man. You know, he didn't take any stuff from anybody. Don't mess with Uncle Robert. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And we went down south. And I think we were in Georgia, and it wasn't a big city like Atlanta. It was a small town. I don't remember. and we got lost. And it was a traffic cop directing the traffic. So as he was driving, he came up abreast with him and said, "Hello, excuse me, hey, bud, can you tell me where?" And he didn't finish his sentence because the cop turned around and said, "What did you call me?" And he didn't think, speaking aimlessly. He said, "Bud." And then he got close to the car and he put his hand on his gun. He said, "If you call a white man Bud, you'll," and he put his hand on his belly, whatever it was, "you'll get your skull bashed in." And I saw this hulk of a man, this daunting figure of a man, become like a little kid that was caught doing something wrong by his parents. And he just drew up apologetic. I didn't know what to make of it. I'd never seen that. But time and time again, those kinds of things did happen. And I guess in a sense, I was intuitively cataloging, and then I came to see that this was something. It was racism, bigotry. And of course, that made me feel, after a period of time, inferior, because who was being put down were other black people like me. And if they were putting down and held in low esteem, and I was a part of that, maybe I wasn't up to par. But then later I said to myself, maybe I'm not given the opportunity to be up to par, and that was a part of it too. Yeah, it took me a while to get out of that. It didn't destroy me, of course. It annoyed me and made me angry.
Well, that would be, you know, an awakening experience for a child.
And it didn't turn me against white people. It never did that. Just the people who did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure they did it because they didn't understand certain things. And they passed that lack of understanding and certitude to the children. And they pick up the banner, the baton. And so it goes on and on. So the laws came into existence and we stripped those things away, the signs for white only and whatnot. But some of those signs still exist in hearts. And that's hard to take down sometimes.
It sounds like that was a searing experience for you.
Yeah, but still, you find tinges and vestiges of it. And nobody says anything. And sometimes you just hear it in the voice. Sometimes you see it in the eyes. And you hear no words at all. Just attitudes. In Europe, you don't get that. We live in Europe. We've lived there for about, during the summer, for about 15 years. We're the only black people miles around. And you never know it. But you know what I say? And I contend this. I can't prove it, but I believe it. If everybody on this earth were jazz fans, we'd have no more wars and killing. You're sitting down and you're listening to Dizzy Gillespie, Coltrane, Miles Davis, Buddy Rich, Dan Getz, then you go out and you kill somebody? That's an anachronism.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about Art Blakey.
Oh, please ask me.
It seems like getting your first gig with him in New York, how did that make you feel?
It made me feel fantastic. It's almost ineffable. It's almost hard to describe the feeling. My best experience in my life was playing with him.
Seriously?
Seriously, yeah. He was didactic, a natural teacher without knowing it. He didn't read. He couldn't read music. He didn't have it up here, but he had it here. And when he played the drums, he played in a way, it's indescribable. He played in a way like no other drummer I'd ever played with. And I got used to playing on that high level all the time for that year or so that I was with him. You get used to it. And when I left his band, I was crippled for 6 months. I couldn't play with another drummer. Sound like he was fiddling around getting ready to play all night.
Really?
Yes. And I would go into a club, or we would go into a club, and another band is playing, and the drums sounded like garbage cans, sounded terrible. And when he sat in, a new life came into existence. Yeah, the same instrument. The same instrument. This man did not know how not to swing. Tired, he was swinging. Sick, abscess, jaw sticking out, played harder. It's incredible.
I mean, it was a really developmental thing for you, because he says, get out of your hole.
Yes, because I wasn't coming up to par. I wasn't fitting in with what was happening. He's bashing hard and emphatically, and I'm playing mellifluously, smooth and flowing. It didn't work. But he didn't tell me that. He would play press rolls. I don't know if you know what press rolls is. Like, it's like a roll, but it starts like a low hum. And for a couple of bars, it leads you into the next new chorus. Shang, there you are. And it's usually two bars. And he could make it loud. And one night I was playing, and he didn't give me two bars of that. He gave me four bars of it. And the crash was unusually loud, denoting the new chorus. And then a couple bars went by, and he gave me another loud crash. So that people, I was pantomiming. People couldn't hear me. And then he hollered over at me, get up out of that hole. And I thought to myself, I must be in a hole. I had to change the way I was playing. It didn't work. And when I left the band, I told you I was crippled. And I happened to mention it to a trumpet player, Freddie Hubbard. And when I mentioned to him, he said, you too? It happened to him when he left. Couldn't play with another drummer.
You really kind of changed things for him and got it moving.
I said, you need something that's going to garner attention. I said, you've done everything there is to do, though. I don't know what you could do. And then I faltered. I said, except play a march. And we both started to laugh. How ridiculous. Then I said, wait a minute. He said, Golson, you got to be kidding. Nobody plays a march in jazz, except when they're going to a funeral in New Orleans. I said, Art, I'm not talking about the typical military march. Have you ever heard that black college in the South, Grambling? Have you ever heard them play marches? I said, their marches are dirty and funky and greasy. Oh, Golson, it'll never work. I said, well, Art, just let me try. Let me try. He thought it was going to fail. He said, okay. He figured there's nothing going to come of it. And I put this tune together, march. I said, well, what form would it be? Typically, a blues. Blues march. Okay, so I put it together, and I called a rehearsal. I said, okay, we're going to do this tune. And I said, you begin, Art. He says, well, what do I do? I said, you remember when the American Legion's band used to come through the neighborhood? I said, when the bugles would stop playing, only the rhythm would play, the bass drum, the snare drum, and the cymbals. And you know how we kids used to do? We used to follow them 10 blocks away from home, following this band. I said, you have to imitate that, what the rhythm section was doing when the trumpet, the bugles are not blowing. He said, well, how long do I play before you and Lee come in? I said, play as long as you like. He said, well, how are you and Lee going to know when to come in? I said, I play a roll-off. He said, what's a roll-off? I can't play the drum, so I had to do it with my mouth. I said, play this. He says, oh, Golson, this is not going to work. Now, we were working at Small's Paradise up in Harlem. I said, look, we're going to play this tune tonight, and the people are going to tell us what they think about it. So I started talking to the audience. Now, it was Small's Paradise. No dancing. The club wasn't set up for that. They had these little round tables. It's big enough to hold a setup, your drinks and whatnot, but no room for dancing. I said, you're going to hear something unusual. I'm introducing. Nobody's ever heard this tune. You're going to hear something quite unusual. Our drummer's going to be featured on it. You'd never expect to hear a march in a jazz club. And I went on and on, extolling the virtues of the march and the ability of our drummer. And we started off. And he played the roll off. Jump, jump, jump. And Lee and I came in. And the people were just sitting there. And then he put a Bobby Blue Bland from a rhythm and blues backbeat into the march. And after a while, you saw the people. They started doing like that. Then it really got into it, and then they started doing like that. Then they got up and started dancing and knocking the drinks over. And he played Blues March right up until the time he died. Everybody that came in that band had to play Blues March. It started. Now, when I left the band, people don't know this. He would call me and ask me what should he do. Because now he trusted me. He trusted me, yeah. It was a nice experience. It was my best experience because of the music.
After that, you went out to California, right?
Yes. I wanted to write for the movies and television and stuff like that. And the reason I got that bug, my friend Quincy Jones, who incidentally we used to be roommates years ago, he went out to Hollywood first, and he kept saying, Benny, you got to come out. So I went out, and Quincy helped me out.
I get that. You know, life is an adventure. Why are you never satisfied?
Creativity never retires. There's always something new to discover. No one person knows everything. I will learn until I leave this earth. And I'm glad I'm not a football player or a boxer or a soccer player. At 87, can you imagine an 87-year-old quarterback? There is no such thing. But there's an 87-year-old saxophone player. And there are things to discover, you know? And it's like driving a car. You don't look behind. You look ahead. So if I've done something that's successful, that's it, and it's done. Now, I'm not going to stand there and pat and rub and ooh and ah. What's next? And as long as I'm living, breathing, and active, hopefully it'll always be something that's next. And when you create things that have no prior existence, it's like giving birth. And I'm always in that waiting room to see if it's a boy or a girl. Symbolic and metaphorically. Yeah, that's what it's like.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.